This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Cinema is falling silent. Something on the soundtrack, something that's been part of our experience of film ever since Jolson sang, is being eliminated. Let me describe it for you. A sort of bubbling, a sort of threshing. Pebbles being sucked from the beach, rats in the wainscot. A sound that told you cinema was a photochemical medium, the product of a frail coincidence of movement and light and halide crystals fixed on a hurtling strip of plastic. Before the digital age, when film was film and not a stream of ones and zeros, when the medium could never fall truly silent, this was the background buzz of the movies, as inescapable as the singing of the blood when you place a seashell to your ear. You'd sense it most clearly at the real change, those subtle junctures in the progress of a picture that every 20 minutes or so kept you aware of the time without you having to turn your watch towards the glow of the exit sign. You'd see it coming, too, with little cracks and scratches, with clouds of tiny imperfections wheeling around and over the figures in the frame. And then, if your eyes were really good, with the brief flash of a dot, a mark, a circle, somewhere near the top right-hand corner of the screen. It was none of your business, that dot. That was for the projectionist, up in a fireproof box behind your head. A projectionist once needed two machines to run a feature, and a fine sense of timing to ensure that the audience didn't take the bump too hard when he flipped from one to another. We'd hear that change, like going over the points or cresting a wave. We don't now. Even in cinemas that haven't made the switch to digital, where a feature still arrives in a pile of tins, the contents are joined together in one continuous strip and set running on a giant metal platter. Half a century ago, it wasn't uncommon for a large cinema to employ seven people in a box, each of whom would control a different aspect of the presentation – lights, curtains, lacing up the films, rewinding. Today, even in a venue without digital facilities, a single projectionist can run 10 shows simultaneously. That's why, when something goes wrong, it can take a long time for anyone to notice. So the reel is dead, and the sound world that it conjured. The revolution that overthrew it took place in the perfect setting, the Tsar's Winter Palace in St. Petersburg. In 2002, 85 years after the Bolsheviks stormed the place, the Russian director Alexander Sokurov marched in with an army of supporters. 2,000 actors, three orchestras, the conductor Valery Gergiev, and a weapon from the future. A camera with a hard drive that allowed Sokurov to make Russian Ark, a film that employed a single unbroken 96-minute shot to take its audience on a phantom ride through several hundred years of Tsarist history. No clicks, no flips, no tricks. A dream of progress that demonstrated what the future of cinema could be, but also took the medium back to its very beginnings, when those 19th century pioneers had used all the time their technology would allow to record workers flooding out through the factory gate, a baby eating a biscuit, a train grinding on its rails towards the camera. Sokurov achieved it, but he wasn't the first to dream of consigning the reel to the dustbin of history. Alfred Hitchcock wanted the audience to think that Rope, his pleasingly poisonous chamber film about the art of killing, had been spun in one long continuous coil. He wanted us to believe that he'd mesmerised the eye of the camera into remaining open and unblinking for the full 80 minutes. He hadn't, of course, and he couldn't. He broke up the shooting script into units of time that matched the limit of a magazine of 35mm film stock, and made the transitions as invisible as he could. So the camera weaves around the room in which the characters are having a party thrown by two silky young students who hope to turn themselves into Nietzschean supermen by committing the perfect murder. And when his camera runs out of film, Hitchcock slopes towards something that will provide him with cover. The back of Jimmy Stewart's jacket, say, which momentarily obscures everything in the hope that the audience won't register the cut. But you can't disguise a real change in that way. In the cinema, particularly after the film had spent a few days streaming through the projector, they would have heard the sound of Hitchcock bashing against the limits of the possible. That crackle, that slight disturbance in the ears. Photochemical cinema is incapable of silence. It's organic. It even feels like something alive. Lifting a reel of film from a can is like hefting a sleeping boa constrictor from a box of Quality Street. So what happens when it tries to be silent? When the actors cease their chatter? When the orchestra puts down its instruments? Sometimes it yields those moments of power and profundity that we seem to crave as we sit in that dark room full of strangers, watching the light move. Moments when the power of cinema, its ability to lull us into a waking dream state, seems strongest. It happens near the beginning of Hitchcock's Notorious, when Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman kiss, with nothing for us to hear but the sound of their lips moving together and the sound of the film's movement through the projector. It happens at the end of William Wyler's 1955 picture Roman Holiday, when Audrey Hepburn, mustering all the grace she can after a night of absence without leave, processes forward to speak to a crowd of reporters. There's no music, even though the great George Orrick is the man inking the notes. There's no nothing, not even the hugger-mugger of the hacks or the flunkies. Hepburn plays a princess who's feeling fragile. She knows that somewhere out there is a set of photographic negatives documenting the indignities of the night before. And suddenly she notices, behind the rope, someone who possesses the power to destroy her. Gregory Peck, a man who knows too much about the world and its disappointments and about her. The night before, she thought he was some nice American expat who helped her when she was in trouble. It's only as she stands there that she realises he's a journalist with the scoop of his life. She says nothing. She doesn't really do anything much either. And Peck does even less. The scene is more about the architecture of their faces than something as vulgar as acting. And the silence helps us survey it and to deduce that all will be well. The screenplay was by Dalton Trumbo, a man who knew the power of saying nothing. 6 years before Roman Holiday was made, Trumbo refused to testify before the House Un-American Activities Committee. The price of his silence was enforced anonymity. Blacklisted by Hollywood, his name was only restored to the credits of the film in 2011. 2 years after Trumbo delivered that script, another blacklisted American attempted something even more daring. The director, Jules Dassin, had spent 5 years exiled from the cinema, unable to find work. Then he was offered a modest little thriller by a French production company, based on a novel that he thought cheap, racist, and unnecessarily kinky. He wrote the script in 6 days and focused only on the bit he found interesting, a jewel robbery, devoting a quarter of the running time to the wordless prosecution of a heist. Again, George Orrick was the composer, and perhaps not understanding the value of his restraint in Roman Holiday, was pretty dismayed to discover that Dassin wanted to gag him and his musicians for the entirety of the sequence. Thinking that his director would probably soon come to his senses, Orrick wrote some music for it anyway. But once he'd viewed a cut of Riffifi, he had the grace to admit that he was the one who needed to revise his views. Instead of urgent brass and strings, we listen to the gang of thieves attempting to maintain all the silence of which they're capable. We follow them through the careful rolling back of carpets and disarticulation of floorboards, the faint fizz of someone dragging on a cigarette, an accidental note on the piano, the piping of fire extinguisher foam into the mechanism of a burglar alarm. John Cage had composed 4 minutes 33 seconds, his piece for musicians that requires them to refrain from playing their instruments for the duration of the work, in 1953. By my reckoning, Riffifi, 2 years later, declines to give us a word of dialogue or a note of music for 23 minutes 49. For me, though, the richest and most humane examples of the effect are less aggressively contrived and occur in the 1930s, when the sense of what a film soundtrack should be was still up for negotiation. What happens, for instance, in those moments when things stop happening in a Laurel and Hardy film? Those moments when the eyes of Mr. Oliver Hardy seem to be returning our gaze. Typically, Ollie does this lying in a pile of rubble, or submerged in a pond, or submerged in a pond under a pile of rubble, or when a brick or plaster bust has just bounced from his skull with a sound like someone pulling a rubber stopper from a stone bottle. And then he turns to us. Sometimes the music remains, that familiar ragtime underscore, as if Scott Joplin were playing in the next room or on the other side of the building site. But often there's nothing. And Ollie gazes and gazes, for far longer, really, than seems absolutely necessary, unless perhaps you were in the original audience for these pictures and saw them in the cheap seats, saw them after having paid your way with empty jam jars or lemonade bottles, and knew that this was your turn to fill the soundtrack. At home, we tend not to do this. We just look at him. We see that band of fat held in place by his jawbone and his wing collar. We see the great fleshy ears, like those fungi that grow on the sides of trees. We see that straggly fringe with its gloss of hair cream, and we hear the roar of what is not quite silence. In a short called Oliver the Eighth, Stan blows the crotch out of Ollie's underpants with a shotgun. Ollie looks not to his friend, but into the frame, into the place in the action where we imagine ourselves to be. The soundtrack pops and scuffles. In a little film called Me and My Pal, Ollie is trying to leave the house to go to a business meeting, but Stan is preoccupied by a jigsaw. And everyone who looks at this jigsaw is so compelled by it that, as in some anxiety dream, the journey becomes impossible. The puzzle distracts them, like all the things that distract us in life until we get to the moment we realise we left it too late to do the things we needed to do. "Do you realise that I'm about to become a big oil magnate?" boasts Ollie. Stan looks blank, or blanker. "You know what a magnate is, don't you?" asks Ollie. We know what joke is coming here, except we don't. "Sure," says Stan, "a thing that eats cheese." And Ollie appears to meet our eyes, and he raises his hands in exasperation. And in that moment of wordless, unscored, un-underscored action, you can hear the sound of his sleeves moving against his shirt, the sound of the chair accommodating the weight of his body. "Get me out of here," this moment seems to say. "Get me from my side of the screen to yours. Beckett never built a prison like this." Digital cinema can generate a purer form of silence. It has other quiet wonders, like, for instance, that long, slow, enigmatic final shot in Michael Haneke's film Cachet, in which suddenly we notice, or perhaps we don't, that there's a familiar figure sitting on a flight of steps within the frame. But as far as we know, film made in the digital era is immune to the stresses of the act of watching it. You cannot wear it out. Mould has no desire to colonise it. One day it will stop looking and sounding new. But it will never look or sound old in the way that a print of a Lumiere film, a Hitchcock film, a Dassin film, a Laurel and Hardy film will look and sound old as it acquires the scars of our interest in it. Nature wants film back, to restore it to its constituent elements, to return it to silver, to camphor, to nitrogen. And nature wants us too. And after that, there'll be time for silence.